Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Deuteronomy chapter 9, verses 1 through 29, the entire chapter, which I will entitle Not Because of Israel's Righteousness. Our context is this. Moses is still giving his second discourse to the children of Israel on the plains of Moab in the last chapter, Deuteronomy 8. He emphasizes the fact that the Israelites should remember the Lord their God when they enter into the land of Israel. So we start now in Deuteronomy 9, verses 1 and 2. Listen, Israel, today you are about to cross the Jordan to go and drive out nations greater and stronger than you, with large cities fortified to the heavens. The people are strong and tall, the descendants of the Anakim. You know about them, and you have heard it said about them, who can stand up to the sons of Anak? Moses says, today you're about to cross the Jordan. As John Gill says, that's not precisely that same day. It means in this general time frame, soon, short time later. Here's the exact days here given by John Gill. Moses began his repetition of the laws on the first day of the 11th month of the 40th year of the exile, Deuteronomy 1:3. And it came to pass in the 40th year, in the 11th month, on the first day of the month, that Moses spoke unto the children of Israel. And then we know from Joshua that the children of Israel crossed the Jordan River on the 10th day of the first month of the next year. That would be the 41st year after the Exodus. That was about 2 months later. So from the 11th month of year 40 to year 1 of the sojourn in Canaan land, it's about 2 months. Joshua 4:19, and the people came up out of the Jordan on the 10th day of the first month and encamped in Gilgal. I haven't really mentioned the time frame here. It's in our previous audios, but we're talking about right before they cross the Jordan. They've got about 2 months to go. 2 months to go from the time that Moses started giving his speeches. Now, Moses mentions large cities fortified to the heavens that the Israelites are going to have to conquer. And it's interesting that in showing this detail, Moses proves that the 10 doubting spies were correct. Those same 10 spies who seduced Israel into running away from their divine duty to conquer the land of Israel. We read in Deuteronomy 1:28, where can we go? Our brothers have discouraged us, saying the people are larger and taller than we are. The cities are large, fortified to the heavens. We also saw the descendants of the Anakim there. So that's the bad report, the evil report of the 10 spies. And those 10 spies said that the cities were large, fortified to the heavens. And Moses says, yes, they are large cities fortified to the heavens. Well, why, if the 10 spies said it, and they are all universally condemned as giving an evil report, but Moses said the same thing, and he's not condemned, what's the difference? Well, the difference is the 10 spies used the fact, they were correct about the facts on the ground, but they were incorrect as saying that God could not overcome those fortified cities, and they put fear into the people. Moses is doing everything he can here in his speech, as we've seen in our previous audios, to encourage the Israelites that they will be able to cross over and to conquer the land. So there is a big difference. Now, who are these? Well, before we go to the Anakim, let's look and see what Jameson Fawcett Brown says about these fortified cities. Quote, they are almost all surrounded with walls built of burnt or sun-dried bricks about 40 feet in height. All classes in the East, but especially the nomad tribes, in their ignorance of engineering and artillery, would have abandoned in despair the idea of an assault on a walled town, which today would be demolished in a few hours. So at the time of the entry into the Promised Land, the nomadic Israelites would have to be faced with these fortified cities, fortified to the heavens, 40 feet high, mud brick, pretty rough. So in one sense, those doubting spies were correct about how difficult the task was going to be, but they didn't count on the fact that God was going to supernaturally help the Israelites overcome these fortified cities and these tall and strong descendants of the Anakim. Now, when you see Anakim, just think giants. The NIV translates it as Anakites, Anakim, same thing. These were the earlier inhabitants of Canaan. They're described as giants, as the NIV Study Bible says. Now, here's a summary of the giants who were mentioned in Pentateuch. There's the Anakim. There's the Emim. That's what the Moabites call them. There's the Zamzumim. That's what the Ammonites call them. And then there's the Rephaim. And the relationship is either tenuous. It's hard to say exactly what the relationship between all these people are. We know in some cases, like in Moab and Ammon, it's the same Anakim that are being referred to. They just give them a different name. Christian Answers even includes the Nephilim of Genesis 6 as being of the same family of giants. So the way I summarize all this in my head is every time you hear Anakim, Emmons, Amzumim, Rephaim, and Nephilim, think giants. Now, they're mentioned a lot in the scriptures. Deuteronomy 2:10, the Emmon lived there, formerly a people as great, numerous, and tall as the Anakim. There it sounds like they're different people. Deuteronomy 2:21, a people as great and numerous and tall as the Anakim, but the Lord destroyed them before them. Deuteronomy 9:2, a people great and tall, the sons of the Anakim, whom you know and whom you have heard it said, who can stand before the sons of Anak. Numbers 13:22, when they had gone up into the Negev, they came to Hebron, where Ahiman, Shishai, and Talmai, the descendants of Anak, were. That's Caleb, wiped those guys out. They were giants. Numbers 13:32, so they gave out to the sons of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, this is referring to the 10 spies, the 10 bad spies, the land through which we have gone in spying it out is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people whom we saw in it are men of great size. They were giants. Now the question is what do these giants have to do with the seven Canaanite nations that the Israelites are about to be confronted with? Well, here's a quote from ChristianAnswers.net. They lived, these descendants of Anak, lived in the south of Palestine in the neighborhood of Hebron. In the days of Abraham, they inhabited the region afterwards known as Edom and Moab, east of the Jordan. They were probably a remnant of the original inhabitants of Palestine before the Canaanites. So, in other words, when you hear these names like Anakim or Zamzumin or Emin, just think of the aboriginal giants who used to live in Palestine before the Canaanites got there, the seven nations of the Canaanites. ChristianAnswers.net goes on, referring to the Canaanites, that they were a Cushite tribe from Babylon of the same race as the Phoenicians and the Egyptian shepherd kings. Well, I don't know about that. These shepherd kings are kind of controversial, but just remember Canaanites are Phoenicians. If you look at where current-day Lebanon is, Phoenicia, you look at an ancient map of the ancient tribes of Israel, a map of the ancient tribes of Israel, you will see that the Canaanites are basically there on the coast of Israel going up toward Tyre and Sidon. Now, going back to the Anakim, their formidable warlike appearance, as described by the spies sent to search the land, filled the Israelites with terror. They seem to have identified them with the Nephilim, the giants of Genesis 6:4, of the antediluvian age. The Nephilim, of course, were a long time before Noah. And indeed, there were men of very large stature among them. There were various tribes of Anakim. Joshua finally expelled them from the land, except the remnant that found a refuge in the city of Gaza, Gath, and Ashdod. That's where the Philistines lived. The Philistine giants whom David encountered were descendants of the Anakim. And that's the last we hear of them. We go down to Deuteronomy 9, verses 3 through 6. But understand that today the Lord your God will cross over ahead of you as a consuming fire. He will devastate and subdue them before you, the Canaanites he's talking about. You will drive them out and destroy them swiftly, as the Lord has told you. When the Lord your God drives them out before you, do not say to yourself, the Lord brought me in to take possession of this land because of my righteousness. Instead, the Lord will drive out these nations for you because of their wickedness. You are not going to take possession of the land because of your righteousness or your integrity. He repeats the same point to drive it home. Instead, the Lord your God will drive out these nations before you because of their wickedness, in order to keep the promise he swore to your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Understand that the Lord your God is not giving you this good land to possess because of your righteousness, for you are a stiff-necked people. Well, it's not because of your righteousness, he repeats three times here in verses 3 through 6. Now, why would that be? Why would the Israelites need to be reminded that they were not righteous? Because they were going to be militarily victorious. They were also going to be prosperous eventually. And it would be real easy for them to say, see, look what we did. No, you are stiff-necked people, Moses said. Remember your history. Now, God has said that he would consume the Canaanites as a consuming fire in verse 3. The Lord will cross over ahead of you as a consuming fire. Now, that's sort of redundant. A fire consumes by its very nature. So if you say fire is going to consume that which is its fuel. But when you say consuming fire, it sort of drives the point home, even though it's a little bit redundant. God is referred to a consuming fire in the book of Hebrews, and I don't have the quote, but well, I'm going from my memory. I hope it's in the book of Hebrews. But we know that it's a terrible thing to fall into the hands of an angry God. Remember that scripture. So God is a consuming fire in the New Testament as well as the Old. Deuteronomy 4:24, for the Lord thy God is a consuming fire, even a jealous God. Exodus 24:17, in the sight of the glory of the Lord was like devouring fire on the top of the mount. It's Mount Sinai, in the eyes of the children of Israel. So God's going to burn them up like dry stubble in a field. Now this idea that the Israelites were not going to burn up the Canaanites because of their righteousness is a repetition of what Moses has already told them in Deuteronomy 7:7-8. We read there the following, "The Lord was devoted to you and chose you, not because you were more numerous than all peoples, for you were the fewest of all peoples, but because the Lord loved you and kept the oath he swore to your fathers. He brought you out with a strong hand and redeemed you from the place of slavery, from the power of Pharaoh, king of Egypt." So let's summarize. The Israelites were not chosen because they were numerous, there in Deuteronomy 7:7. He didn't choose them because they were righteous, here in Deuteronomy 8:3-6. Why did he choose them? Well, later on we'll see he chose them because of the covenant promises he'd made with their father, and because the Canaanites were unrighteous and he wanted to judge them. So that was the real reason, not because the Israelites were hot stuff. Here's this idea that the Canaanites were unrighteous as being the reason for their defeat, Genesis 15:16. In the fourth generation, they, that's Abraham's descendants, will return here from Egypt, return, in other words, to Israel, to Canaan land, from Egypt where they went in captivity. For the iniquity of the Amorites has not reached its full measure. Now, of course, Genesis 15:16 is predicting that which Moses is about to do, or the children of Israel are about to do. And the reason it took four generations from Abraham's time until Moses' time was because the iniquity of the Amorites is just the representative tribe of all the Canaanites. It was the big one, the most powerful one. For the iniquity of the Amorites has not yet reached its full measure. Cup of their iniquity had not filled up. Jameson Fawcett Brown point this out. History relates many remarkable instances in which God punished corrupt and guilty nations by the instrumentality of other people as bad as themselves. So, the Israelites shouldn't consider themselves righteous because they were winning, because God often used nasty, corrupt nations to accomplish his purposes, and those nasty, corrupt nations won, but that didn't mean they were righteous. So don't you Israelites go around start thinking you are righteous. I mean, this is really something. Moses is letting them hold it. He's not sugarcoating the situation at all. And again, in verse 6, he calls them a stiff-necked people. That's not the only time he called them a stiff-necked people. Deuteronomy 10:16, therefore circumcise your hearts and don't be stiff-necked any longer. Deuteronomy 31:27, for I know how rebellious and stiff-necked you are. If you are rebelling against the Lord now, while I am still alive, how much more will you rebel after I am dead? I mean, Moses was not really a politician, was he? Exodus 32:9, the Lord also said to Moses, I have seen this people, and they are indeed a stiff-necked people. Now let's unpack that metaphor a little bit. Stiff-necked, if you take a heifer, baby cow, he's unaccustomed to the yoke. He's not used to working, so you try to put a yoke on a baby cow, on a heifer, and what does he do? He draws back from the yoke and wriggles his neck out of it. He's stiff-necked. Likewise, the children of Israel were not willing to take on the yoke of God's commandments, which were, of course, ironically, bring nothing but freedom to them. We turn now to Deuteronomy 9:7-10. Remember and do not forget how you provoked the Lord your God in the wilderness. You have been rebelling against the Lord from the day you left the land of Egypt until you reached this place. Of course, they're in the plains of Moab now, right at the northern tip of the Dead Sea on the eastern side, getting ready to cross over into the Jordan. Across over the Jordan into the land of Canaan. You provoked the Lord at Horeb, and he was angry enough with you to destroy you. When I went up, Mount Horeb, of course, is Mount Sinai, where the Ten Commandments were given. When I went up the mountain to receive the stone tablets, the tablets of the covenant the Lord made with you, I stayed on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. Moses is continuing. I did not eat bread or drink water. On the day of the assembly, the Lord gave me the two stone tablets inscribed by God's finger. The exact words were on them which the Lord spoke to you from the fire on the mountain. If you recall the story, God spoke the Ten Commandments to the people. The people got frightened and said, that's enough. We don't want to hear any more details. They sent Moses up on the mountain, and then God backed up his oral words by making the words written by inscribing on the stone tablets. It is said by God's finger, however that was, I don't know. Of course, that's metaphorical. God doesn't have a finger. but he blasted, he engraved the words into the tablets Moses had carried him back down, only to discover the children of Israel worshiping a golden calf. So that's the background. If you recall, God is angry enough at that golden calf incident, enough to destroy the people of Israel. Now, in verse 7, Moses says, remember this, how you provoked the Lord your God. And that was provoked at the golden calf incident and other times too. In fact, they spent their time. That's all they did was provoke the Lord. And Moses wants them to remember that, to remember how gracious God was not to have destroyed them all in the wilderness. And the idea of remember your history, Israel, it's everywhere in Deuteronomy. I've already read about 15 scriptures in a couple of previous audios referring to the word remember in Deuteronomy. I don't want to repeat those because I have to repeat them every time I run across the word remember in Deuteronomy, and there's quite a few of them, but it's just remember. Just know that there are many, many, many such instances. It's a common theme. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that Moses wants the Israelites to remember in particular how sinful they were so they wouldn't get cocky as they conquered the land. Now, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown has an interesting comment here. He says, quote, they say, quote, the candor and boldness with which he gave and the patient submission with which the people bore his recital of charges so discreditable to their national character has often been appealed to as among the many evidences of the truth of this history. It does sound different if you read a lot of these ancient sources. The king is the greatest thing since peanut butter. Oh, he's almost godlike, and we don't say anything bad about him. We don't say anything bad about the people. But here, Moses really, really points out how sinful the people of Israel were. So that makes this account unique. Now, Moses says that God was provoked that he wanted to destroy the people. We read that in Exodus 32:10. Now, leave me alone, God says, so that my anger can burn against them and I can destroy them. In other words, Moses, get out of here. I'm getting ready to destroy the people of Israel. Then I will make you into a great nation. He was going to have to start over somehow. We go to Deuteronomy 9, verses 11 and 12. The Lord gave me the two stone tablets, the tablets of the covenant, at the end of the 40 days and 40 nights. Remember, Moses went up on the mountain. The verbal 10 words had already been spoken to the people. He goes up on the mountain, and he fasted 40 days and 40 nights, no food, no water, until he got those two stone tablets. Verse 12, the Lord said to me, get up and go down immediately from here, for your people whom you brought out of Egypt have acted corruptly. They have quickly turned from the way that I commanded them. They have made a cast image for themselves, a molten image some translations have. Now, God tells Moses to get up after that 40-day fast. Get up from which posture? Was he lying down? Well, after 40 days and 40 nights of not eating and drinking, I wouldn't be surprised if he was lying down. Maybe he was sitting. John Gill says, actually, that get up has nothing to do about his previous posture, because Gill says that lying or down or sitting down would not have been appropriate in the presence of the Lord. It just means get a move on, arise, get going. I think Gill's probably right about that. We go now to Deuteronomy 9:13-17. The Lord also said to me, I have seen this people, and indeed they are a stiff-necked people. He's still referring to the golden calf incident. And Moses is relating to what God had told him at that time. Verse 14, Deuteronomy 9, God says, leave me alone, Moses, and I will destroy them and blot out their name under heaven. Then I will make you into a nation stronger and more numerous than they. I've just read you the Exodus version of that. So I went back down the mountain while it was blazing with fire, and the two tablets of the covenant were in my hands. I saw how you had sinned against the Lord your God. You had made a calf image for yourselves. You had quickly turned from the way the Lord had commanded for you. So I took hold of the two tablets and threw them from my hands, shattering them before your eyes. Verse 13. Moses relates again that word stiff-necked. I've seen this people. Indeed, they are a stiff-necked people. We just read that. That's a repetition in this chapter. Verse 6, understand that the Lord your God has not given you this good land to possess because of your righteousness, for you are a stiff-necked people. He comes down from the mountain, sees the golden calf, gets his two tablets of stone that God had written the Ten Commandments on, and he broke the stones. He shattered them in front of all the people. Now, here's some options as to why Moses did that. Option number one, he just got ticked off. He was angry. The breaking and shattering of the tablets was the result of the heat of intemperate, sinful passion? Well, maybe so. That's option number one. Option number two is he broke the tablets out of righteous indignation. In other words, he was angry, all right, but he had a right to be. Jameson Fawcett Brown put it, Moses had a zeal to vindicate the unsullied honor of God. In other words, he broke the tablets as if to say, you sinful people are not worthy of such a holy law. So I'm breaking it, and you ain't going to look at it. Option number three, to show that the covenant had been broken and the people thus excluded from divine favor, as Jameson Fawcett Brown say. I think it could be a combination of option two and option three, righteous indignation, angry at the people, and also to show that the covenant had been broken, option three. We go down to Deuteronomy 9, verses 18 through 21. Then I fell down like the first time in the presence of the Lord for 40 days and 40 nights. The first time is when he had gone up, fasted 40 days and 40 nights, and then God wrote with the finger of God on the stone tablets and gave Moses the Ten Commandments. Now, this is after the golden calf incident, after he had shattered the first set of tablets, and then he goes back up on the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights. I did not eat bread or drink water because of all the sin you committed, doing what was evil in the Lord's sight and provoking him to anger. I was afraid of the fierce anger the Lord had directed against you because he was about to destroy you. But again, the Lord listened to me on that occasion. The Lord was angry enough with Aaron to destroy him. Why Aaron? Well, he was the guy that went along with the people in making this golden calf. And he was the high priest of Yahweh, for crying out loud. He deserved to be destroyed. Moses continues, but I prayed for Aaron at that time also. I took the sinful calf you had made, burned it up, and crushed it, thoroughly grinding it to powder as fine as dust. Then I threw it into the stream that came down from the mountain. Now Moses in verse 18 says he didn't eat or drink for 40 days because of all the sin that the people committed. What sin would that be? Well, John Gill suggests idolatry, unbelief, ingratitude. I wonder if in the incident of the golden calf idolatry, they were feasting. They were having an idol feast, really, whether there was some religious prostitution going on. I wouldn't be surprised. But at any rate, whatever it was horrible. And that's why the Lord had fierce anger directed against them, as it says in verse 19. Now, in verse 19, Moses says, again, the Lord listened to me. He's referring to the prayer, which we'll see in verse 26 when we get there. He basically prays that God won't destroy them. So he prayed for that. He also prayed for the people of Israel. He also prayed for Aaron, that Aaron would not be destroyed, as it says in verse 20. Now, I'm going to give you two examples of prophets of God praying for the preservation of the people of Israel from God's righteous anger. 1 Samuel 7, 5 through 9. Samuel said, gather all Israel at Mizpah, and I will pray to the Lord on your behalf. When they gathered at Mizpah, they drew water and poured it out in the Lord's presence. They fasted that day, and there they confessed, we have sinned against the Lord. And Samuel judged the Israelites at Mizpah. When the Philistines heard that the Israelites had gathered at Mizpah, their rulers marched up toward Israel. When the Israelites heard about it, they were afraid because of the Philistines. The Israelites said to Samuel, don't stop crying out to the Lord our God for us, so that he will save us from the hand of the Philistines. Then Samuel took a young lamb and offered it as a whole burnt offering to the Lord. He cried out to the Lord on behalf of Israel, and the Lord answered him. So Samuel cried out for the salvation of the Israelite nation from total destruction. So that was a very prominent prayer for Israel's preservation. And Moses, of course, as we just saw, did the same thing at the golden calf incident. Now, Jeremiah mentions both Moses and Samuel. In Jeremiah 15:1, then the Lord said to me, even if Moses and Samuel should stand before me, my compassions would not reach out to these people. Send them from my presence and let them go. Now, Jeremiah is referring to these scriptures that I just quoted, the one in Samuel, 1 Samuel 7, 5, and 9, and the one in Deuteronomy 9, in our chapter here, Deuteronomy 9, 18 through 21. Jeremiah refers to these prayers, and the Lord took note of it. He said, even if Moses and Samuel, in other words, these were bodacious prayers for the preservation of Israel, but even if I got another prayer that good from you, Jeremiah, they're going down, which of course happened from the Babylonians in 586 B.C., So Jeremiah's a little bit different. He prayed for the salvation of Israel. God said, no, Moses and Samuel prayed, and God said yes. Notice in verse 21 that the calf is called a sinful calf. I took the sinful calf you had made. Well, if you think about it, a calf can't be sinful because a calf's not a human being. This is just a shorthand way of saying the calf of sin that you made, the calf that was created because of your sin. Minor point. Now, this is interesting. Moses took that golden calf, ground it up to powder as fine as dust, and I don't know how he did that, but I'm sure he had ways of doing it. And again, we don't know whether the golden calf was a wooden calf quoted with or covered with gold plate or whether it was solid gold. I don't know. But after Moses ground it up to powder, he threw it into a stream that came down from the mountain. Now, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that that stream was the same brook that came from the rock at Rephidim. Remember, Rephidim is close to Sinai. That was where Massa and Meribah, the people complained. We'll talk about that in just a minute. Massa, at least. And that happened within the first year of the Exodus. And, of course, Moses had struck the rock to get the water to come out at Rephidim, which was near Mount Sinai. And so Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that that water that Moses had gotten from the ground by striking the rock was actually supplying the Israelites, and that Moses then took the ground-up idol and sprinkled it into that water and made the Israelites drink it. Well, that would mean the water would have to travel many miles to get to Sinai, so that's an interesting speculation. I really don't believe it. But wherever the stream was, the Israelites were forced to drink ground-up golden calf, powdered golden calf. Well, what was the purpose of that? My speculation is this, is to make the idolatrous gold become feces, because if the Israelites ate the gold powder, they would have to eliminate the gold powder, and so the golden calf would end up on a dung heap in dust, which is a great picture of how God conquers idols. We go down to Deuteronomy 9, verse 22. You continued to provoke the Lord at Taberah, Massah, and Kibroth Hattaavah. Three places on the Exodus, which happened there in the third month or so, in the second year of the Exodus, right after they left Mount Sinai. They built the tabernacle, packed up, and were headed north to Kadesh Barnea from Mount Sinai. So Moses is moving in chronological order here after the golden calf. The first thing, the problem the Israelites had was at Taberah, where they began complaining because of hardship. Numbers 11, 1, 3. Now the people began complaining openly before the Lord about hardship. Doesn't say particularly what hardship. I guess they wanted to go back to Egypt, where they had beautiful tapestries and delicate food. Of course, they were slaves, but that's what they were thinking. When the Lord heard their complaints about hardship, his anger burned, continuing in Numbers 11, verses 1 through 3, and fire from the Lord blazed among them and consumed the outskirts of the camp. Then the people cried out to Moses, and he prayed to the Lord, and the fire died down. So the place was called Taberah, because the Lord's fire had blazed among them. Taberah means burning, as the NIV note says. And so the place was called Taberah. Now, I said that Moses is going in chronological order. Actually, he is in general, but not Massah. Massah is referring back to Rephidim, which happened before they took out, about a month before they ended up in Mount Sinai. Now, I'll just give you a little summary of what happened there. The people complained about lack of water, so Moses struck the rock at God's behest, and water came out and watered the people. Now, they named the place Massah and Meribah because Massah means temptation and Meribah means quarreling or provocation. Because they tempted the Lord and they provoked the Lord. And so the names became symbolic. Mentioned a lot, Massah is, and Meribah too. Deuteronomy 6:16, do not test the Lord your God as you tested him at Massah. Remember, Massah means testing. Deuteronomy 33:8, he said about Levi, your Thummim and Urim belong to your faithful one. You tested him. Urim and Thummim are the tools that the priest used to find out God's will about something. Probably, nobody knows what they are. My guess is they're black and white stones that were kept in the breastplate, and one stone for yes and one stone for no. But anyway, he said about Levi, you tested him, God, at Massah, temptation. Tested him at Massah, testing, Massah. Massah means testing. You tested him at Massah and contended with him at the waters of Meribah. Meribah means provocation. Exodus 17:7, he named the place Massa and Meribah because the Israelites complained and because they tested the Lord, saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?" And if you think about it, testing and provocation are pretty close. You test somebody, you provoke them. Now, these symbols, Massa and Meribah, are used in the New Testament. Hebrews 3:7-8, "Therefore, just as the Holy Spirit says, today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as when they provoked me," that's Meribah, "as in the day of trial," that's Massa, "in the wilderness." In fact, the Hebrew for Meribah is the same word that is rendered provoked in the Exodus 17:7 account, as Jameson, Foster, and Brown, the NIV Study Bible say, and the Hebrew for trial is the same word that is rendered trial here in the New Testament Greek. As you go from Hebrew to Greek, we won't follow that trail, but it's the same words are used as you go from Hebrew to Greek to English. All right, so verse 22 says, the people continued to provoke the Lord at three places. Taberah, provoked because of hardship, and there was fire on the outskirts of the camp. Massa, which means testing, and Kibroth Hattaavah. Now, let's read Numbers 11:34 to go back to the incident at Kibroth Hattaavah. This took place after the third month in the second year, the 20th day. That's when the Israelites left Mount Sinai. And at some time after that, it's unclear, they got to Kibroth Hattaavah. Numbers 11:34, so they named that place Kibroth Hattaavah because there they buried the people who had craved the meat. Now what happened is people were complaining. They got tired of the manna. God provided them with the manna, but they got bored with it, and so they started complaining, and God said, "Okay, I'll give you quail," and then the wind shifted apparently and blew tons of quail all over the camp, and the people were out there collecting the quail till the quail was stacked up, and then they ate the quail until they were stuffed, and then they got struck with a plague. Well, what does this word Kibroth Hattaavah mean? I got three different translations. The NIV note translates it as graves of craving. John Gill translates it as graves of lust. And BibleAtlas.org translates it as graves of greed. Graves of craving, lust, and greed. Much more striking for the English ear than Kibroth Hattaavah. We go now to Deuteronomy 9, verses 23 through 25. "When the Lord sent you from Kadesh Barnea, he said, 'Go up and possess the land I have given you.' You rebelled against the command of the Lord your God. You did not believe or obey him. You have been rebelling against the Lord ever since I have known you. I fell down in the presence of the Lord 40 days and 40 nights because the Lord had threatened to destroy you." Now, Kadesh Barnea is the place from whence the spies were sent to spy out the land. Numbers 32:8. "That's what your fathers did when I sent them from Kadesh Barnea to see the land." Now, the rebellion here that God is talking about when he's speaking to Moses, or actually Moses is telling the people that you, the people of Israel, rebelled against the command of the Lord. That rebellion is talking about not listening to the two favorable spies, Joshua and Caleb, who said, "Go up and take the land." Instead, the Israelites refused to take the land. And then Moses says, "You've been rebelling against the Lord ever since I've known you." Now, that could be when he first visited them in their slavery. Exodus 2:11, years later, after Moses had grown up, he went out to his own people and observed their forced labor. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his people. That's recorded also in Acts 7:25, Stephen's speech. He assumed, that's Moses, he assumed his brothers would understand that God would give them deliverance through him, but they did not understand. Remember, Moses was rejected at first. That could have been what he's referring to. They rebelled because they didn't choose him as their leader. Or it could be when he was first sent to the Israelites to deliver them out of Egypt and they accepted him, Exodus 5:20, when they, the Israelite foremen of the slaves, left Pharaoh. They confronted Moses and Aaron, who stood waiting to meet them, and then the rest is history. But anyway, that was a long time ago. It was over 40 years ago, and they've been rebelling from the day he met him to the present day that he's talking to him. Ever since he's known him, you people have been rebels. Now in verse 25, he says, "I fell down in the presence of the Lord 40 days and 40 nights because the Lord had threatened to destroy you." Now remember, there was 40 days and 40 nights without food and water twice on the mountain. Once before he received the laws written down to write down to take down from the mountain to the people. That was after the oral deliverance of the Ten Commandments at the foot of the mountain. In other words, at the writing of the first tablets, and then he fasted again after he had to smash the first tablets and go up and get a second set of tablets. There was 2 40-day and 40-night fasts. I don't know how in the world Moses survived this. Some people say that Moses is actually referring to a third time he fasted 40 days and 40 nights. John Gill, the famous commentator Lightfoot, say that. I don't know why we have to say that. Just whenever he did it, he did it at least twice, maybe three times, 40 day and 40 night fast, because the Lord had threatened to destroy you. Now, I'll tell you what, that takes a lot of patience to put up with a people as rebellious as Israel and then the fast for them for 40 days and 40 nights. Moses is a cut above. We go now to Deuteronomy 9, verses 26 through 29, and we'll finish this audio. I prayed to the Lord. This is Moses saying, I prayed to the Lord. Lord God, do not annihilate your people, your inheritance, whom you redeemed through your greatness and brought out of Egypt with a strong hand. Notice that the Israelites are called God's inheritance. I'm surprised that God would want such an inheritance, but he did. Verse 27, remember your servants Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Moses continues. Disregard this people's stubbornness and their wickedness and sin. Otherwise, those in the land you brought us from will say, because the Lord wasn't able to bring them into the land he had promised them, and because he hated them, he brought them out to kill them in the wilderness. But they are your people, your inheritance, whom you brought out by your great power and outstretched arm. Now, we see the main problem here, the problem that comes up all the time. It's an old, old tension. God needs to punish his people because they're terribly wicked, but if he punishes them by destroying them, then his name is besmirched, because the people of Israel were famous for being the people, the inheritance of Yahweh. So if God kills his own people to punish, to give them their just deserts, then he makes himself look bad. And so what God would do, he would punish, but he would temper his punishment so that the covenant promises were still maintained, and Israel ended up taking over the promised land despite all those punishments. For example, the people in the wilderness that died were those under 20 who were not part of the census. They are the ones that eventually went in, but the people over 20 all died in the wilderness. So they were punished. Israel was punished, but there were still other people God left alive in order to fulfill his covenant promises. This is mentioned in verse 27. Moses says, remember, well, he's talking about what he had prayed to the Lord earlier. This, by the way, these three verses are Moses' prayer to the Lord. I mentioned this earlier. This is when he prayed that God would not destroy them because of their sin, mainly at the golden calf incident. Moses prays to God in verse 27, remember your servants, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. What he's saying there is, remember the covenant I made with those three patriarchs, the famous covenant of land, offspring, and blessing to the nations. And of course, God did remember that covenant. Now, I just said that this prayer that Moses had prayed to the Lord was at the golden calf incident. Actually, I think it was, but commentators will dispute when this was. I'm not going to get into the details on that. I just think it's easier to say it happened at the golden calf incident. Let me give you two places, scriptural places where this happened, Exodus 32, 31, and 32. So Moses returned to the Lord and said, oh, these people have committed a grave sin. They have made a god of gold for themselves. Now, if you would only forgive their sin, but if not, please erase me from the book you have written. Deuteronomy 9, 19. I was afraid of the fierce anger the Lord had directed against you because he was about to destroy you. But again, the Lord listened to me on that occasion, which I take to be the golden calf incident. That's in this chapter, the chapter we're going over right now in verse 19. So Moses prayed famously for God not to annihilate. That's a great word. Destroy is the word used. Sometimes this word here in Deuteronomy 9:26 is annihilate. He knew that the Israelites were facing annihilation because of their sin. Now let's summarize, as John Gill does, the arguments Moses used to ask God not to destroy Israel. First of all, because of the covenant promise. In verse 27, he says, remember your servants, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Second reason why he asked God not to destroy Israel, because of the shame it would bring on God's name. As in verse 28, those in Egypt will say, because the Lord brought them out of the land he promised, because the Lord was not able to bring them into the land he had promised, because he hated them, he brought them out in the wilderness to kill them. So that's reason number two, the shame it would bring on God's name. The third reason that Moses appealed to as to why God should not annihilate the Israelites is because Verse 29, they are your people, your inheritance. Why would you destroy your own inheritance, God? Moses is constantly arguing with God in many places as to why God ought not to destroy the people. And there's three good reasons he gives God right there. He begs God not to carry out what he knew would be a just sentence on the people of Israel. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished Deuteronomy chapter 9. We are prepared now to go to Deuteronomy 10, verses 1 through 22, the entire chapter. And in that chapter, we'll see Moses recounting the story of how he made new tablets of stone after the golden calf incident, and then Moses' exhortation to circumcise their heart as opposed to their inyong. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you enjoyed this audio. Hope to see you next time.